The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. So, I'm interested this evening to hear what kind of questions or topics you'd like to discuss. Maybe we can discuss the Dharma or the practice together. For last few months, many months that I've been here, mostly I've given talks, I believe, long talks. So I thought it was time not to talk so much, but to hear a little bit what's on your minds, your hearts, what your concerns are about practice. So maybe we need a few moments for you guys to change gears and see if some of you have some questions or topics you'd like to discuss. You have to hold it close to you. Kind of, if you hold it horizontally, it works a little better. Yeah.
Thank you. I've been curious about.
It also needs to be on. It's a group. Sorry.
I've been curious about how you find the balance between self-compassion and compassion for others, and how you know where that line is, uh-huh. and when you're out of balance, and how you. I don't know. I'd be interested if you could talk about that.
It's a great question, but can I ask you, why are you asking the question?
Because I realize that I am out of balance, and for me it comes naturally to feel compassion for others and be immediately wondering what they need from me and not able, having trouble setting the right boundary.
It's a common, very common problem for many people, and but how do you know that you're imbalanced?
Because of a heart problem I've been having, uh-huh. I think it's just made me reevaluate.
So a heart problem.
And recognizing that so many of my relationships, I just right away go to that, what do they need from me? And maybe that's the right thing. Maybe I'm not out of balance.
You recognize you're imbalanced because you have some kind of heart problem, maybe a physical heart problem, your heart races a lot, or...
Yeah, I mean, and maybe it's not related, but it's made me reevaluate.
Maybe it is. And what about, and also you recognize there's some problem in your relationships that stand out, that get highlighted eventually?
I think so. It partly came up for me because I've been seeking out people who are calm and bring me, you know, some people make you feel more calm and tranquil and other people make you anxious. So I've been seeking out those calm people, but then the anxious people keep coming to me, and I don't know how much is it my role in life to be the calm person for them. Do I need to keep spending time with them, and are they looking for my calm, or can I not be with them and spend time with more
tranquil? So, I'm asking this question because I'm wondering whether what would help you find your way with this question is for you to become more sensitive to when you're imbalanced. Because it sounds like right now, it sounds like you recognize a little bit you're imbalanced in a little abstract way. You have this idea, maybe I'm imbalanced. And maybe you need to pay more attention not to how to find the balance, but for you to discover what it feels like to be imbalanced. And so what goes on in your heart, you know, both physically or metaphorically. When do you get the signals inside of you that there's a tension, you feel uncomfortable because people are asking more than you want? Your own discomfort is a very important signal in all kinds of ways. So if you can become much more familiar with how it feels when something is off, you feel something's a little off, so you feel familiar with it that you can smell it coming, then you might, once you've done that homework, really gotten good at it, then you'll be in a whole different position to ask yourself how to come into balance. Because then you'll have the evidence to where the imbalance is. You actually know, you know, what to address. So I would suggest that's your first task.
Okay, thank you.
Forget about this compassion thing. Rather, just really familiar what it feels like to feel off, to be something's wrong. And look for opportunities and study that, study it, take end of the day, look back over the day and review, where might I, how was I feeling today, and where did I feel off? And when you do feel off, kind of stop and take a look at it and be with it and, you know, explore. And that's my suggestion.
Thank you.
And what happens sometimes is when people do that, just doing that brings you back into balance. Thank you.
I have a very basic question about the practice of meditation, and it's to do with when I try to take thought away when I'm meditating, and it keeps coming back constantly, and sometimes it just takes over the whole session I was sitting for, and it's really hard. It can be someone something from the past, and even if I try to bring myself to the present, to the now, it keeps coming back again, and it takes the whole session. So can you tell me how to take control of that? It's like a monkey that you don't want to think of, and you can only think of monkey then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question that many meditators would like answers to. It's easy when people meditate to assume or want to have a quiet mind. The instructions that, you know, for example, of just sit down and focus on your breath, stay on your breath, sometimes highlights how the mind doesn't want to be there. It's thinking and you're so distracted and all that. So if only that thinking could stop, and then I could really do the practice. And what happens sometimes is when people are people react to that thinking, they judge it, and that just stirs it up even more. So we use an analogy in our scene. Maybe you've heard it of a forest pond that is been stirred up. So the mud is in solution and it's just swirling around, and you can't see the bottom because it's all muddy. And if you wanted to get, if you don't like the mud swirling around because you want to see the bottom, then you might go get a big stick, and you take the stick and you swirl the water, try to get those particles to get, you know, down. And it doesn't work, right? That just keeps it all in solution, spinning around. And what you have to do is you have to stop stirring it up. And when you stop stirring it, then the mud will finally settle. So part of the art of meditation is to learn how to leave the mind alone, leave the thinking mind alone, not react to it. And trying to stop it is a way of reacting to it. So there's part of the art is to learn how to not to be involved in thinking, but at the same time not being reactive to it. And it's summarized in a very short teaching that I received many years ago that was helpful for me, which was, don't be bothered by your thinking. So that was really helpful for me. So that's the first thing to say. Should I say more, or is that enough for today? You start from there? Okay.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's a little cabal in that corner right there.
So my model of the Vipassana method is pretty much what we've been talking about. Your mind drifts away, you realize it's drifting away, and you return to the breath. And you stay there as long as you can. But oftentimes we're guided by you or other teachers to contemplate something. And I'm not sure how to actually jibe that with the model, or whether we were really trying to do something different and shouldn't be doing the pulling back to the breath.
Yeah. And what do you mean by me asking you to contemplate something? When do I do that?
Might talk about, if we're talking about right speech or right intention, for example.
On Fridays I do that sometimes.
Right.
That's for Fridays.
So a different model on Friday.
Different model on Friday. I do what's called the Dharma practice days once a month on Friday, where the task is to explore a particular Dharma topic, practice topic for the day. It's very nice. And so there we're exploring it from many, many different angles. So there we do sometimes in meditation, meaning when people sit quietly for some time, their eyes are closed and meditating quiet, that I ask them to ask them a question to contemplate in the meditation itself. And because sometimes when the mind is relatively quiet and you're somewhat settled internal and not you're not pulled into the social world around you, sometimes the contemplation, the thinking can go deeper and unexpected things can come up in that kind of situation that's useful. So it can be a wonderful technique or approach to bring up a topic for contemplation in the space of when we're meditating. Generally, I mean, I do it on Fridays because it's useful on Fridays, but I generally don't teach it many other times, partly because it's different than the mindfulness. Mindfulness is not thinking about things, it's about being present for what is there. Present is kind of a choice word. It doesn't mean thinking about something, but it's more like standing, you know, if you stand on the beach while the sun is setting, you can watch the sunset and be in awe of the colors of the sunset without thinking and analyzing the different colors that are there. Just there, and just there in a quiet mind, you're registering it. And because some people are so addicted to thinking, it's often good to emphasize this non-discursive side of mindfulness as being important. And so that's distinct from thinking about a theme. And so at different times, different approaches is useful. So some people find it useful to what might be called contemplation of a reflection. In Buddhism, it's more often called reflection. You're reflecting and thinking about something. And there's some great topics for reflection. One of the classic ones in the tradition is to spend some time reflecting on death. There's something very significant about spending time contemplating death for some people, it gets them to rethink their priorities and what they want to do with their life. It gets them to confront and deal with some of the important issues they have around death and dying that some people will avoid at all cost. And often the whole idea of death interferes with people's ability to live. And so sometimes it's good to look at that issue directly. Sometimes the contemplation of death helps put people in the present moment in a much more full and embodied way. So that's a classic one in Buddhism. And there's others as well. So the thing about mindfulness, so mindfulness meditation is different than contemplation practice. So it's very important to distinguish between those two. And in mindfulness practice, there's many different ways of practicing it. There are different teachers will emphasize different ways or have different emphases for it. And there's a book by Jack Kornfield called, used to be called Living Buddhist Masters. But now, since all those masters except one is dead, they retitled it. I think it's called Living Dhamma or Living Dharma. Is that what it's called? Someone knows? Living Dharma. Jack did it in the 1970s, so it's been a long time ago. And one of the nice reasons, it's a nice book to read, but one of the reasons it's nice to read it is you see how in Southeast Asia, there are many different teachers who had very different approaches and techniques for how to teach mindfulness meditation or vipassana. And then you get a sense it's not just one way. And so, I have my own particular emphasis. It might be different than for other people. But the way that I was taught and the way that I like to teach is to give some emphasis on the breathing and keep that as the default, as a place to develop concentration and mindfulness, until such a time that something happens that makes it hard to be with the breathing. And as soon as there's something that makes it hard, you feel a tension, a pull, push, like you feel like you're trying to be with the breath, but something else is really what's going on, then the instructions are to let go of the breath and take on that other thing as the subject of mindfulness, this non-discursive attention that brings attention to it. So if it's emotions, you would let go of the breath and feel the emotions. If it's body sensations, you'd feel the body sensations. And if it's thinking, you would turn around, rather trying to let go of thinking, you turn around and look the thinking right in the eye. And you say, thinking. You say, you really see it. See it for what it is. And that way you can learn how to be present and mindful and non-reactive and in a certain kind of way independent from whatever's going on by bringing your attention to it rather than having something go away. And to really become free in all the circumstances of our life, it's more useful to learn how to be mindful of everything than it is to get rid of anything. If you rely on always getting rid of something to be free, then you're not really free. So this idea of turning the attention towards what the distraction is, and the difficulty is whatever, and just bringing your attention quiet, careful. I like a calm, deliberate, equanimous attention. Just feel that, be with that, whatever's going on. Does that make some sense? So that would be different than picking up a theme. So yeah, so is there another mic over there? Or is right mic.
Yes, hi there. Along those same lines, if the teachers have different interpretations of what they do in the meditative state, does that then give you some liberty to experiment in that realm? You know, when you get to a deep settled state, for instance, say if you're a Christian and you say, well, might have a little chat with God right about now.
I think that usually meditation works a lot better if there's a kind of a playful attitude or curiosity or trial and error that goes on. The idea that there's a fixed, perfect way to meditate is just a burden. And I think mindfulness meditation works best if there's a process of trial and error. You try something, you learn what that's like. You find your way. And hopefully you have fun in it. You enjoy the process. It's interesting. You go into your The idea, though, however, in the mindfulness meditation in classic Buddhism, is to keep it really simple and quiet. And there is a direction that it's going. So it would be a distraction to start talking to God when you meditate, because that's kind of a discursive and active thing. It's using a relatively coarse part of the mind to be in discursive. Yeah.
I'm using the term loosely.
Commune. Yeah. No, anything that you're doing in meditation at some point becomes a very subtle, no matter even very subtle doings, is a very subtle agitation. And the course of the movement in this kind of mindfulness meditation is to go from a coarser activity of the mind to finer and finer, more refined activities of the mind, until finally the mind is so equanimous and peaceful that you could almost say there's no activity going on in the mind at all. And so if the classic direction is what a person wants to do, it's trial and error, it's a little playfulness, finding your way, letting the mind become stiller and stiller. And so at some point when it gets really quiet and still, sometimes it can be very tempting, some wonderful thought or image or imagination, idea of what should happen come up. There's nothing wrong with picking that up and doing it, but it's, it would be going, the direction for mindfulness itself is to keep going to this quieter and quieter place.
So, for instance, if you're reciting a Buddhist prayer, generally those are done at the beginning and they should not reoccur during the process.
The process. The we do whatever is helpful. And so, we're monitoring ourselves, paying attention to ourselves. We see where we're at in our practice, in our life, what's going on. And so in seeing what's happening, we say, what's helpful right now? What's a useful thing to do? And I've known people, right in the middle of, a long session of meditation or a long retreat, who find that there's so much difficulty, the best thing to do is to do what we call a kind of a prayer, which is loving kindness meditation. So that's very discursive, it's using words to do it, and because it's just what's needed at the time. And I've known people who regularly will do some chanting or some silent reciting of something as a regular thing at the beginning of their practice and at the end. So it all depends, what's needed in any given time. I'm somewhat very reluctant to say there's a one way or should be one way. It's more like we're finding our way, freedom from suffering. We're finding a way what's helpful and meaningful to become free. And so there's a variety of ways of doing that. But it isn't that we're given a carte blanche to do whatever we want. Because we have, it takes some sophistication, some care to understand what the mind is doing, to be able to question really well that what we're thinking of doing is really to the point or useful. Human minds are capable of a fair amount of delusion as well, or to be able to distract itself. And so to be wise about how to find our way is, you know, part of the task. Does that make some sense?
Yes, yes, it does. Thank you. And one other short question. Is there any, do you have any thinking on the benefits of meditating in group as opposed to alone?
Uh-huh. Yeah, some people find it very helpful to meditate in the group. Some people don't like it. Some people find that it agitates them. But I think generally people who find it useful to meditate in the group find it useful for a variety of reasons. One reason is that it's easier to be disciplined in a group. It's easier to kind of like 45 minutes. Might be hard to do at home alone at home. But to do it here, it's kind of easier to sit 45 minutes because of the group. Some people find it very helpful and meaningful to see that there are other people who are meditating as well, because otherwise the only meditator they know is themselves, and they feel like they're kind of the odd person, you know, and their family thinks they're odd, their colleagues think they're odd, their friend thinks they're odd, and it's just nice to know there are other people who are odd. So you feel some, you know, the company's good. And sometimes we learn from others by meditating with them. Even when people don't talk to each other, there is a kind of biosmosis, a kind of learning that goes when we sit together and share the space and share the stillness. And sometimes there's a kind of quality of stillness that can be very, very strong when a group of people are sitting together. And so you can tap into that, you feel that, you learn something about it. There's a certain kind of way, healthy way, sometimes unhealthy, but a healthy way in which there's a kind of feedback loop or reflection, or we see how other people conduct themselves in a meditation group, and we say, that's how it can be, you know. So it's not uncommon for some people to come here and notice how some of the longtime practitioners are basically kind people. And they find that's really inspiring to have such many kind people at work. We don't have that so much. And so it's nice to come here and feel that. And that supports their, inspires them to do their practice and things like that. And then some people, sometimes when people are quite adept meditators and they have the ability to get quite deep and still, then sometimes coming to a large group prevents them to go as deep as they possibly can go. But then what we say is that that's good, that's okay, because that just gives you something, it's a sign that there's something for you to work on, to go to that level where you get stopped because you're in a group. And because the idea is to be able to practice anywhere. And then after someone, you know, for me, I practiced in groups pretty much for years in monasteries. And then at some point I went to Southeast Asia, to Thailand, and to meditate there, and I showed up at a monastery, and the abbot gave me a little hut at the edge of the monastery. It was kind of like the edge of the rice fields, and I had to walk across this kind of swamp and this long plank that went off this little hut that I had by myself, and it was right next to someone's grave. They had this big cement grave, and you know, just me and the grave, and I was left out there to meditate. I was told to go out there and do your meditation all day, sitting meditation, walking meditation, and then tomorrow come and see me. So I did that. I saw him the next day, and then every day that was the routine. I had this 10-15 minute meeting with the teacher, and otherwise I was mostly just practicing and meditating by myself in my hut. And it didn't take me long to realize that I'd never meditated so much alone before. And what I realized then was that I had been relying on the group, not only for meditation, but the discipline, showing up, going to the meditation sessions when the schedule said to meditate. The group momentum kept me going in a very nice way. It was very supportive of me, and I was able to do a lot of practice. But then when I was in Thailand, that little hut, I said, wow, this is really different. Now I have a new task. Now the task is for me to discover the discipline to do this alone. And that was really good for me. It was to learn how to muster up the motivation, the intention, the commitment without the support of a group of people. Sometimes it was peer pressure. Make sense? Okay, thank you.
I was hoping you'd be willing to tell us a bit about what when...
Green light?
Better?
Yeah.
What your meditation practices were like when you first started off meditating now after 20 or more years of having a seated practice?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. You mean like how it was difficult in the beginning and how now it's not difficult?
Well, kind of.
You want a good story?
Yeah, no. Well, I should be honest. When I first started coming here about a year ago, I was just determined to just be able to sit for 45 minutes with my eyes closed. And it was about nothing other than to just be able to do that simple task.
Yeah, that's a good...
It's different. Now it's almost like wanting more.
Great.
But then sort of the analogy, it's like my whole life I've wanted to go to Bhutan. And it's almost like you're from Bhutan. And so I want to kind of find out what's out there, you know, sort of what am I looking forward to kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, yeah. You can do a tremendous, wonderful journeys in your own mind. Meditation is a great, you know, it's a great path to take on. Great vistas to be seen. So I think like most people, meditation was in some ways a challenge for me when I started. But also I was hooked pretty much right away as well to it. And some of the challenge, I had all kinds of challenges, if that's what you'd like to hear about. But I had a mind that was very, thought a lot, but I was kind of lucky in my early years of practice because I was introduced to meditation through Zen. And in Zen, they give very little instruction. And they don't talk about the mechanics of meditation like kind of we do sometimes, like, you know, concentration and mindfulness and all that. And the basic instruction that I was given was sit up straight, and be present for whatever's going on with unconditional acceptance of what is, just to be with what is. And so there was no idea that I had to get rid of anything, and there was no idea that thinking was wrong and I was supposed to stop thinking. And that was very lucky for me to begin there because in those early years of meditation, it didn't occur to me that thinking was wrong or thinking was wrong or bad or something that I shouldn't be doing. My thinking kind of receded from the background. So that wasn't really a problem. But I had a lot of restlessness and I had a lot of emotions and feelings that maybe came, you know, through my thinking partly. So I sat with a lot of strong emotional feelings, and there were times when I cried meditating because of the grief or the sadness that would come up. I had a lot of physical pain when I meditated. So in Zen, you weren't supposed to move at all during this 40. It was 40-minute meditation, and there were sometimes I could only get through the meditation session by telling myself, I had one or two little mantras I would say. I would say, moment by moment. I was going to get to the next moment. That's all, then they could do it again. And the other one was I would tell myself, what if this is forever? And that somehow helped for a moment or two. So sitting there with pain was a big part of my early years of practice, and so I did that, and so I had a lot going on for me, and then slowly. But the hook for me was that really kind of what propelled me on this whole path of meditation, Buddhism, and then eventually teaching was the hook that got me into it was, to my surprise. In meditation, those early years, I started feeling a feeling of what I called back then integrity, a kind of a sense of integrity that was there when I meditated. And that sense of integrity was something that was just seemed really important, really meaningful. It just was good. It was just there. And it became so important, so meaningful for me, the sense of sitting there. So I wasn't, my mind wasn't necessarily wasn't particularly concentrated. It wasn't stop thinking. I wasn't a good meditator, and you know, in some conventional sense of what it meant to meditate. But this practice of the unconditional acceptance of the moment here, to my surprise, led to a sense of inner integrity, wholeness, authenticity, something like that. And then at some point it dawned on me that the difference between my mind in meditation and outside of meditation was kind of arbitrary. I mean, it's the same mind, right? So and then I thought, well, when I thought that, then I said, well, why don't I have this integrity the rest of my life? And so it was the quest to discover how to do that that then brought me into Buddhism and everything. And so it wasn't so much to meditate more, that it was more how to discover how to live this integrity in my life. But the result of going into Buddhism to discover that was I started meditating more and more. And so that, you know, so I don't know if that's as adequate as a response to you. I don't think you didn't have a particular question, you just wanted to hear something. Someone else? No, no. Or maybe the battery's dead. Where's the other mic? No. We pass the other mic over, and you can pass that mic to the console here. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that one has a green light. Last Wednesday or Wednesday a week ago, you said you talked about mindfulness on that last mindfulness meditation class, about mindfulness when you walk through a hallway.
Yes.
Or when you do daily tasks. 3 days later, I walked into the garage and it was underwater and a pipe had broken. And personally, I found it was a big deal that I didn't panic. I went back inside because it wasn't gushing. I went back inside and got coffee and did my meditation time. Then I asked for help of everybody that was...
Let me say, I don't think I followed that completely. So your garage was flooded.
I went back inside. You didn't panic.
Instead, you went back in the house and meditated.
Right, which I thought was pretty good because then I knew what to do.
So that
was the first big thing. The second big thing was then I asked for help and I got it, which I don't usually ask for
help. And if
help.
You hadn't meditated, what do you think you would have done?
I would have panicked and you know...
And done nothing.
...raced around and pretty much spent the next hour trying to fish stuff out of the garage and brainstorm it myself. And it would have been a real good disaster. So that was actually quite good. The real good thing came a couple of days later when that pipe got repaired because it was in the foundation and the water was off pretty much for 2 days long. And I realized how much I depend on water in the house running. So I didn't have warm water for 5 days, which was kind of an interesting situation, and I was very grateful to the neighbors that they let me take a shower there. There was no dishwasher I could use, which means I was actually kind of mindful of how many dishes I would use because I had to wash it with cold water. And when the 2 days where I didn't have water in the house, I would do something in the kitchen and I would try to wash my hands and there was no water. And I mean, it gave me an unbelievable state of mindfulness every time now I turn the faucet on and not only I have water, but I have even hot water.
Oh,
and actually there's a shower every morning. I know that sounds really weird, but it was very apropos that it happened 3 days after you talked about in daily life.
So you've learned through that the value of being present, of mindfulness in a higher quality way. And how has that improved your life? How have you benefited from that?
I'm so much calmer. I mean, this idea of not racing around and being just... I mean, the result would have been the same. You know, I would have found out that it's the hot water pipe being broken. But I would have been totally exhausted. This way, I was not. I was actually quite sane. which is really cool.
And then the mindfulness, when you had those two to four days without water, how did you benefit from that, besides just, you know, there was...
Maybe just gratefulness. Every time I hear water running now, I'm super grateful. When I mean, it's true, I go to the toilet and it refills the tank. That's a pretty big miracle. I'm really super grateful.
So being mindful, it's a little bit like stopping for a moment. It doesn't have to be stopping, but a little bit like stopping in order to notice what is happening rather than rushing on to the next thing. And then there's great opportunities for all kinds of things, including gratitude, times, appreciation, deeper insight, deeper connection. Great, it's lovely. Thank you for saying all that. And I once taught a retreat, I think Laura was there, right? Where the 10 to Koji, we had 2-week retreat and we had 10 days with no water. And it was one of the best retreats I ever taught. Because, were you there? You were there too?
It rained
and there was no running water. And because it was between the rain and no running water, everyone just stayed put and meditated. And it got really still and people went really deep. It was quite lovely, I thought. I thought, well, I should do this more often, have the water. Yes, please.
Yeah. I have a question which is maybe a little bit provocative, but I like to turn every stone. And I remember you talk sometimes in your talk about addiction.
Addiction, yes.
Yeah. And so I was wondering if, you know, Ever thought about meditation addiction?
Oh, people addicted to meditation.
Yeah, addicted to meditation.
Yeah,
and
it can happen.
Also, another aspect is meditation and perfectionism.
Perfectionism. Yeah. So people addicted to meditation. So some people are addicted to, like, perfectionism, would you say? So they're just they're not addicted to meditation, but they're addicted to their idea of what it's going to do for them. And so they just keep meditating and pushing. So that's one way. But through meditation itself, usually because meditation is so enjoyable and they get pulled into the enjoyment of it, the meaningfulness of it. And in terms of things you can be addicted to, this is not so dangerous. It's not so bad. Though, you know, it can have some problems. I mean, if you're married and have kids and all you do is meditate, you know, things might fall apart, you lose your job. And so there can be problems like that, but... in and of itself, it's not necessarily like a terrible thing. I don't think I'm so worried about it because generally it's self-correcting. And so because it's self-correcting, it might actually in a certain kind of way be helpful to have a little addiction or attachment to meditation because it keeps you doing it. And you're exploring it and developing it nicely for some time. And then at some point, it has to happen. At some point, as a person is developing a meditation, you'll come to a point where a person sees very clearly the limitation and the problems of that addictive behavior, that clinging, that wanting, and is self-correcting at that point. So generally, I'm not so concerned about it being a problem because of the self-correcting nature of it. Does that make some sense?
Yeah. I was curious to see if you unfold some drawback of meditation, but it seems...
Generally, not. A guideline that I was given by my Zen teachers many years ago it came up in two different ways, but the clearest way was this way. I went to my teacher and I said, I've noticed that when I don't eat very much, I'm much more concentrated in meditation. What do you think of me not eating so much? And I was really thin, you know. I mean, now I'm, you know, I was really thin. He said, fine. He said, you go ahead and not eat so much as you wish. And until people tell you that maybe you start eating again, eating more. And so that idea that you don't listen to what people tell you, the feedback you get. So if you're married and your spouse says, you know something, you know, it doesn't work for you to be meditating all the time this way. And, you know, the kids need you and you need to go to work. You know, so you, it's good. That's one of the reasons why it's good not to meditate in isolation. Do a spiritual practice in isolation, because sometimes it's really good to get feedback from other people. Because sometimes you get gung-ho. It's possible to be involved in the spiritual tradition and get a little bit imbalanced. I mean, possible. I think everyone involved in spiritual tradition gets imbalanced a little bit. And that's part of the path. As you get, we find, just like driving down the freeway, no one drives straight, right? We drive almost straight, and that's good enough. But, you know, you start to make these little corrections. So on a spiritual path as well, you know, you're almost going well, you know, but you're always a little bit off. And so you're always finding your way. But I think it really helps to have a community of people or certain individuals around you who are willing to give you some feedback. And then say, you know, I think you're a little bit too far off now. You're up on the shoulder. I think come back. So if you're worried about addiction, being addicted to your meditation, go ask some friends. You know, tell them what you're doing and ask them what they think. You think this is okay? And they say, oh, it's great. You've been so much better person ever since you started being addicted to meditation. You're so much nicer to be around. Keep doing it. Or they'll say, you know, please stop. You know, this is too much. So one more, and then we'll stop. Oh, Bruni has something. Last one is Bruni.
So along those lines, I've been noticing subtle changes in my meditation. I'm sleeping less, though I'm rested. And there's sometimes that when I finish, well, the meditation is integrated in my daily life. So now I'm referring to sitting and then transitioning into my daily life activities. And I noticed that there's a very subtle resistance of the mind to engage or think, or let's suppose I just leave home and I start interacting and someone is speaking to me, and I suddenly feel like a shift in the mind, or a whispering saying, I don't want to talk, or I don't want to think, or it's not exactly that. I don't know how to put it into words. It's just like a sensation in the body.
Uh-huh. It could be so. It could be, for example, that if you talked about you're meditating nicely and you're not needing to sleep as much, you're getting kind of a deep rest. Indicates to me that your meditation, you're getting pretty quiet in meditation. Your mind is very quiet. And that quiet maybe comes with you into daily life. And in that quiet, you know, it's like if you spend a lot of time whispering to someone, whispering, it feels very nice to whisper. And maybe you're talking to your lover and you're whispering really nicely. And then suddenly your lover kind of yells and says, let's go! you know, and like you can't make that transition. Like, please, you know, I don't want to yell back, you know, and you know, it just feels too active and too busy. And so I could see your mind's getting quiet. And so you have to kind of, in order to talk at the same level as someone else who's talking to you on the street, you have to pick up the activity of your mind to be a little bit louder in your mind as well. And there can be inertia to do that. I think it's natural enough. I don't think it's a, you know, problem. It's a problem if you resist it. It's a problem if you refuse to budge. And but if there's a little bit, you feel the inertia, feel the difference, and then you say, well, you know, I think it'd be good to connect to this person, and then you bring yourself up to that level, and so you can meet them and talk in a normal way, so they're comfortable with you. If you're kind of barely whisper because you're so quiet, and the other person's like, you know, loud, they might get uncomfortable with you, and so the idea is to kind of match the person.
Thank you.
Does that make sense? Yes, I hope that makes sense. Okay, well, I hope that was nice for all of you, especially all of you who didn't ask questions. I certainly appreciated the questions, and it's nice to hear what on your mind, what your concerns are. And so I thank you all for that. So I wish you a good week.